board with our plan, but I was hiding my actions even from them. It was a lot of weight to bear on my shoulders, and I really wanted to bounce my insanity against Knuckles or Jennifer, the two sounding boards who routinely kept me on an even keel, but I couldn't. To do so would put them in jeopardy. If this thing went to complete shit, at least they'd be able to claim innocence. Brett heard gunfire ahead and slowed down. He said, "The headquarters is just around the corner. I thought you said it was secure." Johan looked up and said, "It is. They're doing some cleanup." We all knew what that meant. Cleanup was code for vendetta. I said, "I thought this was supposed to be surgical. None of the bullshit from a real coup. That's what you told us." He grimaced and said, "It is. Andy has the police headquarters. He's a little loose."
"And he's the guy you need to convince?"
Johan had already ordered the evacuation of his men on the other targets. The original plan was that they'd leave the objectives in control of the ranking Lesotho Special Forces officer, who'd hold down the fort until General Masebo and the new Prime Minister, Lenatha, consolidated control. In the meantime, the mercenary force would flee the country, leaving behind the wonderful new government. Johan's deviation to the plan was to show up at the police headquarters, order the evacuation of the team there, then free whatever police were still alive, taking them to the airfield for a little surprise when the aircraft with the new Prime Minister arrived. Johan said, "I can handle Andy. It won't be an issue. He trusts me. I'll get him to leave, then call you in."
Brett said, "You sure about that?"
Johan said, "Yeah. I can hold up my end of the bargain. As long as this guy doesn't piss his pants." Going in with Johan was a man named Kosi, one of Thomas's inner circle. Johan was supposed to be co-located with the Special Forces Regimental Commander, and wasn't expected to show up at the police headquarters at all. Him showing up would be a surprise, so we needed to give him every edge he could get. Johan was convinced that appearing alone would raise all sorts of red flags, and he wanted someone to play the part of the Special Forces staff. Since the guy would have no role other than eye candy, I'd originally tasked Brett. But Johan had axed that idea, saying he didn't speak the language, which could prove crucial if any of the locals threw a question his way. We batted the ideas back and forth, and a man from Thomas's circle had stood up. He wasn't Special Forces, but he'd served in the Lesotho military and had volunteered to help. His courage was pretty impressive, given he was going into the lion's den. All of the Lesotho Special Forces men had assaulted in civilian clothes to prevent anyone from fingering a specific unit when it was over, giving the coup a veneer of a popular uprising. So it was a simple matter of changing Kosi out of his prison rags and into something more appropriate. The charade was complete with a banged-up AK Aaron had taken off the base. Kosi shifted the AK in his hand and said,
"I won't lose my nerve."
Johan said,
"You know how to fire that weapon, right?"
Kosi nodded but said,
"I thought that wouldn't be necessary."
"It won't."
Brett passed across his earpiece and task force phone, saying,
"Don't lose that shit. I'm signed for it."
Johan smiled and opened the door to the SUV. He said,
"I'll call when it's clear. You guys come in loaded, because we need to get the drop on whoever is left behind. Worst case, if the comms fail for whatever reason, if you don't hear from me and you see two white guys driving off, come on in."
I nodded, then said what was on my team's mind. "Good luck, Johan. Don't fuck us here." If he wanted to turn the tables on us, we were giving him the perfect opportunity. He said,
"You still don't trust me, do you?"
Aaron said, "No, I don't."
80. Johan left the SUV, went to the end of the street, and took a knee, peering around the corner. He saw four men with AK-47s in the parking lot of the police headquarters, pacing back and forth and looking for trouble. It was enough to prevent him from attempting to walk right in. The headquarters was a squat one-story building surrounded by chain link and razor wire, with a single vehicle entrance and two pedestrian gates. The vehicle entrance was blocked with the hulk of a destroyed sedan, the interior on fire and billowing smoke. Scattered about were the carcasses of dead policemen, their blood congealing in the morning heat. Kosi took one look at the carnage and the armed men and said, "Maybe this isn't a good idea." Johann said, "Yeah, you're probably right, but we don't have a choice now." Johann got on the radio and was relieved to hear Chris, the American Special Forces man, on the other end. "Hey, this is Johann. I need to come in and coordinate." "What's up? Something going wrong?" "No, no. It's just easier to do it face-to-face. The TV station is only a couple blocks from here, and I've got everyone else moving out to the airfield. I just want to finalize with Andy before we bring in the aircraft." "Okay. Where are you?" "Right out front. Can you turn off the gorillas that are pacing the parking lot?" Chris laughed and said, "Stand by." Johann saw Chris enter the gravel lot, say a few words, then walk to the pedestrian gate, pushing a body out of the way to get it to open. Johann showed himself, and Chris waved him in. Johann and Kosi sprinted to the gate, leaping over the broken remnants of the police force to get there. They entered the building, and Johann saw four more bodies, only this time lined up neatly in a row on the floor of the lobby of the headquarters. Each had a bullet hole to the head. Johann said, "What the fuck is that?" Chris looked embarrassed. He said, "Masebo's boys got a little out of control. They said it was payback for something." "Where the hell is Andy?" He heard, "Right behind you, mate. What are you doing here?" Johann pointed and said, "What happened?" Andy said, "Lily boy, sometimes you have to let the savages blow off some steam to keep them in line." Johann snarled, "You bloodthirsty fuck. You're in charge here, not them." Andy leaned against the wall and said, "What's done is done. Now, why are you here?" "It's time to evacuate. Almost all objectives are secure, and I've got the teams headed to the airport. The only target still hostile is the Prime Minister's residence." "That's settled. The Prime Minister's dead, and the team evacuated. Didn't you hear them on the net?" Johann showed true surprise. He said, "No. When did that happen?" "I spoke to them an hour ago, and they were still fighting." "An hour ago? What have you been doing since then? It sure as shit wasn't acting as the ground force commander." "I was at the television station in accordance with the plan. When did they leave?" Andy ignored the question, saying, "Yeah, speaking of that, why is the fucking station transmitting?" "What?" Andy pointed at a television in the corner and said, "They're broadcasting." Johann said, "That must have just started. I'll take care of it when I get back. Look, it's time to go. We still need to secure the airport for reception of the bird." "Where's the regimental commander?" "Colonel Goodluck." "He's at the station." Andy unslung his weapon and said, "At the station, huh? Who's this guy?" Johann felt the first tendrils of fear. "He's Goodluck's adjutant. His name is Kosi. Now start packing up your shit. It's time to go. I talked to Colonel Armstrong, and he's preparing to land, but he can't until we secure the airport. Everything's tracking." Andy said, "You know, Lily boy, Colonel Armstrong never trusted you. He respects your skill, but not your moral compass." Johann casually brought his weapon up, and Andy said, "Stop. Put the rifle down." Johann did, slowly, saying, "What the fuck has gotten into you? We need to go." Andy said, "It's funny you say you spoke to Colonel Armstrong, because I just got off the net with him, and he didn't say a thing about talking with you." And Johann realized that Colonel Armstrong had been watching him all along. His plan to turn the coup on its head had been defeated before he'd even boarded the aircraft. He decided to throw everything on the table, hoping to convince Andy to join his side. He said, Andy, Colonel Armstrong is giving nuclear triggers to Tyler Malloy, and Tyler is going to sell them to terrorists. We can prevent that. We can let the coup go forward, but we can stop that. Andy said, I don't give a shit about nuclear triggers. I care about getting paid, which means I need to prevent whatever you've set in motion. He flicked his head, and two of the Special Forces men descended on Kosi, ripping the AK-47 out of his hands and driving him to his knees. Andy said, Since I'm sure it would take an awful long time to get you to talk, and as you say, we don't have any to waste, I'll start with your friend here. Johann said, Andy, we don't have to fight. We need to work together. We're not fighting. You misunderstand your position. Didn't Colonel Armstrong tell you when you talked to him? I'm now the ground force commander. Chris, watch him. Chris raised his weapon, his expression one of bewilderment. Johann realized the turn of events was as new to him as it was to Johann. Kosi began to struggle, but it did little good. The last thing Johann saw was the terror on his face as they dragged him away.
81. We waited for about 20 minutes, and I heard nothing from the task force radio. I called in. Johann, this is Pike. Give me a sit rep. I got silence. I turned to Brett and said, Go to the corner, get eyes on the headquarters, and give me some intel. Dawn had finally broken, and the sun was beginning its slow rise into the sky. Up and down the street we could see groups of people roaming, moving about like packs of wild animals, the stores along the street belching looters out of their broken windows. Brett exited, keeping his Glock low and out of sight. He peered around the brick wall at the corner, then pulled back into cover. Over the net, he said, Headquarters looks like a war zone. Four guys out front with AKs and about a half dozen bodies near the entrance. I said, Roger that. Any sign of Johann? Brett stuck his head around the corner and said, I don't see him. Stand by. There's a vehicle coming out. He whipped back around and leaned up against the brick, looking at me through the windshield. He said, They're winching a wrecked sedan out of the way. Two SUVs coming out. The lead has a Caucasian and three locals. The second SUV is nothing but locals. Both vehicles armed. 5 minutes later, I saw the caravan appear at Brett's corner, and we ducked down, letting it pass. I sat back up, staring hard as the vehicles disappeared from view. I said, Did anyone catch who was in that front vehicle? Knuckles said, I didn't recognize the white guy. No, I meant in the back. It looked like Kosi in the back, in the middle. Brett returned to our vehicle saying, We going in now? I don't know. He said two Caucasians. That was only one, which means there's another mercenary still on site. I called, Johann, this is Pike, what's going on? We heard two clicks of the microphone, usually meaning whoever was on the other end was acknowledging they'd received the call but couldn't talk. Aaron said what was on everyone's mind. You think he's fucking us? I opened the door and said, Yeah, I do. And that bastard is going to wish he hadn't. We slipped up to the corner, and I saw the four guys Brett was talking about. I said, Okay, Brett, you cross and conduct a close target reconnaissance. Focus on the southern pedestrian gate, report back, and get ready to join the fight. Veep, Knuckles, same plan as the prison. Remain here and neutralize those guys when I call. Veep, you still have your breaching charge?
Yeah, one left.
Get it. I looked at Aaron and said, You and I are going down the alley in the back. See if we can breach somewhere without the heavy firepower. Veep returned and handed me the small charge. And I said, Objective is to clear that target and capture both Johann and the final mercenary. Local nationals are designated hostile threats. We'll leave after we get atmospherics from Brett. Questions? Brett said, I'm getting the CTR because of my lethal skills. With a straight face, I said, Yes, that's why. He tucked his Glock into his pants, dropped his shirt over it,
and turned the corner saying, "Lion sack of shit." Aaron chuckled, saying,
"One of these days, he's going to take a front to your taskings."
"Yeah, well, the next time we're hunting mercenaries in Norway, it'll be me pretending to be a local." Brett reached the end of the block and said,
"I can see bodies inside lying execution style. The men outside took an interest in me, but not much of one. No sign of Johan from my vantage point, but I saw two other locals inside. Alley is clear."
Which brought our target deck up to 6. I said, "Continue into the alley. We'll meet you there." To Veep and Knuckles, I said, "Drop those targets, then use the primary entrance to breach." Knuckles nodded, saying, "I'm getting a little sick of the sniper work." I said, "Do it quickly, and there might be some fighting left inside." Then patted Aaron on the leg to go. We went down our building until we hit an alley that ran perpendicular to the police headquarters. Overgrown with shrubs and weeds fighting a battle with the asphalt, it was full of trash, making our stalk a game of avoid the cans. We reached the intersection of the alley that paralleled the southern end of the headquarters, and I saw the chain link extended another 50 feet, before stopping abruptly and joining the brick of the building. Brett was waiting for us, hiding in the shadows of a cluster of trash cans. He said, "I could only find one breach point on this side, a door about 30 meters down, but I can't tell where it goes. The rest is just brick all the way down." Shit. I really didn't like being forced into a single choice of breach, especially since it was an unknown one. Worst case, we'd find we entered into a storage area or some other dead end. It was one of the reasons we usually breached from 3 or 4 different directions at the same time. "No other intel on where it leads?" "No, I tried. But there aren't any windows in it or near it. It's just a steel door. There is a camera above it, so it probably has access to the rest of the building. No reason to put a camera on a breach point unless that breach point is a risk. Besides the door, there are a couple of windows between here and it, but they're barred. Both just offices with nobody inside."
"Can we surreptitiously enter the door, check it out?"
"It's got a triple lock. We can do it, but it's going to take some time."
"Well, the windows aren't an option, and we don't have time. Looks like it's an explosive breach on the door. Let's hope we're not leaving all the fighting to Knuckles and Veep when we pile into a paint locker." We advanced down the alley until we came to the end of the chain link. I could see the door ahead, a camera above it. Aaron said,
"You worried about the surveillance system?"
"No. I doubt whoever was tasked to watch it is still alive." I tossed Brett my breaching charge and said, "It's showtime." He scampered forward and emplaced it between the deadbolt and the doorknob, a position that would shred all 3 locks. I called the Overwatch team. "Knuckles, this is Pike, at breach. You ready?"
"Roger."
"Go on the sound of the boom." I checked with Aaron, then nodded at Brett. He pulled the fuse igniter, then raced back to us, getting behind me in the stack. 10 seconds later, the locks were obliterated in a cloud of smoke, and we raced into the building. The first room turned out to be for storage, empty of men, but it spilled into a hallway. On the net, Knuckles called,
"Targets down, moving to primary breach."
We exited into the hallway, and a man sprang out of a room ahead of me, holding an AK. He didn't even glance our way, instead running away from us. He reached the end of the hallway, still running flat out, weapon raised at a threat. And then he flipped in the air, landing on his back, like he'd been clotheslined from an invisible I-beam across the hallway. His head split open. Knuckles. I raced to the door he'd exited, pulling up short. I felt a hand on my shoulder and kicked the door in, going right while the man behind me went left. I saw Johan on his knees, his hands flexed tied behind his back, a Lesotho Special Forces man above him holding an AK. I put a double tap into the soldier's chest, hearing firing behind me, and Johan tossed his head repeatedly, trying to point with it and screaming, "Behind me! Behind me!" He was indicating an open door, and I raced to it just as a 6-hour MCX barrel appeared, followed by a large Caucasian man. His eyes sprang wide, and he tried to rotate his weapon toward me. I grabbed the barrel, slammed it against the door jamb, then punched him in the face with the end of my suppressor, a quick bayonet jab that left a circle on his forehead.
He lost his weapon, staggered back, windmilling his arms, then fell heavily on his ass. I pointed my rifle at his head and said, "Don't fucking move." Behind me, I hollered, "Status!" Knuckles appeared at my shoulder, saying, "Building's clear. You got one room full of police all hogtied, another room full of police all dead. Threats? Neutralized. Watch this fuck." I returned to the room, finding Brett at the door pulling security and Veep cutting Johan free. I went to him and said, "What the fuck is going on?"
"We're in a world of shit. Andy is working with Armstrong, and neither one trusted me. Andy has Cosi, and they're headed to our little safe house for Thomas. They're going to kill him and his men. We're about to lose."
82. Shoshana watched Clint talking to the head nurse and prayed she wouldn't make things worse. If they could drive away from this, they'd be home free. She had no idea that it wouldn't be the hospital, but Pike who would throw the plan into the gutter. Clint walked over to their SUV and said, "We can secure this, no problem. It's away from the city and gated. I've talked to my boss at SOCOM, and they've gotten wind of the problem. They're spinning up a Marine fast team and some Ospreys from the Med. It'll take some time for them to get here since we're on the bottom of the earth, but you girls don't need to worry anymore." Jennifer said, "What's the embassy telling you?" "It's a coup. A real coup, but it's calming down now. The worst is the looting at this stage. My orders are to stay here and protect AMSITs. Apparently, someone told them to congregate here." He pointed to the front gate where Shoshana saw couples and families coming through, dragging suitcases and trunks full of whatever they thought they'd need fleeing a country under fire. Clint said, "I don't know who's pulling the strings back home, but this is ridiculous. Typical overreaction. You mentioned Benghazi before, and apparently that's solidified like puke on a toilet seat. Now I'll spend my time herding a bunch of cats while the U.S. government wastes billions proving that no crisis is too small to wave the flag." He spit on the ground and said, "Christ, tomorrow I'll have 14 dignitaries stomping around proclaiming how quickly they reacted to this non-threat. It'll be a clusterfuck of epic proportions." He realized he'd been a little more than crude and said, "No offense, I mean I saw your friend, but she'll be okay." Jennifer said, "I'm sorry, we were so scared, I didn't know what to do." Clint glanced at Shoshana in the passenger seat and said, "I know, I know. Running alone here could be scary, but trust me, I've seen much worse in Uganda. Not your fault." Shoshana leaned forward, about to say something, and Jennifer pinched her hip. Shoshana relaxed, but only because Jennifer was in the seat next to her. She really wanted to teach the man a thing or two about defenseless women. He said, "You might want to stake out a sleeping place while you have the chance, because it's looking like the good spots will be taken shortly." He tapped the roof of their SUV and walked away, supremely disgusted that there hadn't been a fight. Shoshana said, "That guy is so arrogant, he's going to trip on his own ego." Jennifer said, "We're good, we did what we needed. A bunch of Ospreys landing here disgorging Marines will prevent anyone from raising a weapon after they arrive." She patted Shoshana's knee and said, "I'm just glad we didn't have to give him any sexual favors for showing up." Shoshana laughed, and Jennifer's cell phone rang, ending the good times. Shoshana saw her go from proud to worried. Jennifer said, "Is Cosi alive?" Then, "What can we do?" Shoshana began bouncing off the seat, with Jennifer holding a finger in the air, her ear still glued to the phone. Jennifer said, "Pike, I don't think he'll execute that." Shoshana heard snatches of noise from the phone, and Jennifer looked at her, saying, "I've got Shoshana. We'll do what we can." Jennifer ended with, "I won't. I won't. Get to the airport." She hung up the phone, looked at Shoshana, and said, Kosi has been captured. Colonel Armstrong was suspicious of Johann from the start. He didn't trust him. They're going to kill the bunch of them. And? And we're a click away from the safe house. Safe hut. They're on the way, and Pike needs us to beat them to it. Jennifer rolled down the window and shouted at Clint's retreating back. Shoshana said, "Just us?" He turned around, and Jennifer said, "Not if we can convince that guy to get in a fight." Shoshana smiled, pulled her ZevTech Glock, did a press check to make sure a round was seated, and said, "You might want to ask him his favorite position." Thomas peeked out the window one more time, seeing nothing on the road. Not even a local walking, which was strange. It had been close to an hour since they'd watched the so-called force leave to execute their plan at the police headquarters, and nobody had come back. The man called Pike had promised him they'd return, and when they did, they'd take him to the airport to arrest the man who'd instigated the coup, and in a fit of insanity, he'd agreed. They'd infused him with confidence and plied him with shame. But now, an hour later, the gravity of what they were doing was wearing him down. Nobi sat down next to him and said, "This is a great day, a day to remember." He patted Thomas's knee and said, "All of that suffering, every day, you said it was for a purpose, and now that has come to pass." Thomas wiped his brow, feeling sick, and said, "Don't count on victory until victory is assured." "What do you mean? You've seen what's happened. It is our time." They heard a vehicle pull up outside, and a man looked out the window and said, "It's Kosi." Nobi's skeletal face broke into a smile. He said, "No more pain, no more hunger." Kosi entered the hut, his face battered and bleeding. Thomas sat upright, saying, "What happened to you?" A man shoved him forward, then pointed a wicked-looking rifle at Thomas, saying, "I'm sorry about this, but your friend is wrong. There will be more pain."
I hung up the phone, and Knuckles said, "You sure you want to do that? Get U.S. forces involved directly in the coup?" Aggravated, I said, "What the fuck was I supposed to do? Let him die?" Brett said, "I'm with you, but he's got a point. Getting a U.S. Army Special Forces team to rescue Thomas is definitely taking sides on this thing. Going to be hard to explain that when we're done." "Well, fuck it. It'll be that much harder for the U.S. to back away from supporting Thomas after they saved his ass. They'll come up with some bullshit story, but he'll survive." I turned to our captive, saying, "What sort of vehicles are here? What do you have?" The man named Chris, now on his knees with his own hands secured behind his back, said, "We've got a van and a couple of Toyota 4Runners. Knuckles turned from a window and said, "Street's getting a little crowded. People are starting to shout for a police response to the looting. We need to leave." I nodded and squatted in front of Chris, saying, "What's the plan now?" "Andy's talking to Colonel Armstrong. He's landing in the next 30 minutes. The coup is done. He meets General Masebo on the airfield and we leave." I said, "Masebo's dead, you dumb fuck. There is no Masebo. Get with the program. What are you supposed to do?" Chris's face went slack at the news. I said, "Wake the fuck up. What's next?" He said, "Andy's going to call, and I take Johann with me to the airfield." He glanced at Johann, the fear in his eyes, and said, "I was supposed to hand him to Lenatha. He's going to be implicated in some bullshit with the coup. We fly out, whatever happens here happens." Johann said, "Not anymore, you shit." Chris nodded and said, I know, I want no part of this." He glanced at the bodies on the ground, some killed execution style, and said, "This wasn't part of the plan, I don't murder for money." Johann said, "Yes, you do, you myopic fuck. You just did." Chris said, "What makes you so pure? You planned this entire thing." Johann looked at Pike and said, "I did. No doubt I did."
but I'm going to right my wrongs. The question is whether you're willing to do the same.
How? Johann squatted down to Chris's level and said,
You're going to take me to the airport, just as planned.
83. Seeing the skepticism on Clint's face, Jennifer turned on the waterworks, saying, He isn't American, but he worked at the hospital. He just called me and said armed men were surrounding his house. They're going to haul him away and kill him just because he worked here. Apparently they hate anything American. Clint said, What the hell are you talking about, lady? This isn't Rwanda. All that's happening here is some looting. There aren't any roaming death squads. There's clearly at least one. He just called me. They're going to kill him and his family. Clint gave her the side eye, clearly thinking she was overwrought. The harrowing ride with her wounded friend battering her fragile female sensitivities. After seeing the hospital and the lack of danger, he was sure she was imagining the threat. Shoshana had had enough of Jennifer's acting. She opened the door to their vehicle, leaned over the roof, and said, Look, you shit. Get your men loaded up. If it's nothing, it's nothing. A smart-ass comment formed in Clint's mouth, but failed to escape. One look at Shoshana, and it died, stillborn. He nodded and said, You lead, like before? Yeah, we'll lead your team. You ride with us. It's only about 1 kilometer away, but tell your men to be ready. You wanted a fight, and you're about to get it. Like all the rest, Thomas was led out of the hut under the watchful eyes of the Lesotho Special Forces members. He saw the mercenary called Andy load up into one of the SUVs, then call for one of the Special Forces men. They held a brief conversation, and then the man came back. He said a few words to his team, then led the line of men behind the small Basutu hut and into an open field toward a shallow stream at the back. Thomas realized Kosi was in front of him, his face swollen, the blood crusting beneath his nose. Andy started up the SUV, and the vehicle began to roll, passing the men marching in the field, then disappeared. They reached the edge of the stream, and the man who'd spoken to Andy screamed at them to get on their knees. Thomas did so, glancing at Kosi. He mouthed, I'm sorry. Thomas hung his head in shame, waiting on the bullet.
His hand still shackled. Chris put down the hand mic and said, They've got Thomas and his men. They're dead, or about to be. Colonel Armstrong's inbound. He's landing in 10 minutes with Makala Lanatha. They've seized control of the airfield. It's all in motion. I said, Brett, find me a policeman who speaks English. He came out a minute later with a guy who looked like he was about to throw up, convinced we were going to torture him to death. Because I was a smartass, I said, You speak American? He looked at me quizzically, and I asked, Where's the captain of this place? He pointed to a body on the ground. One of the ones lined up and executed. I said, Who's the highest-ranking guy you have here? Still alive, I mean. He drew up and said, That would be me. If you must kill again, kill me. I said, As much as I appreciate the courage, I'm not going to kill you. I need the ranking man left alive. My words giving him courage, he said, Why? I pointed at the body of the captain and said, Because we're about to arrest the man who did that. His mouth curled into a smile. He said, It's still me.
Jennifer crested a hill, and two SUVs passed her, headed the other way. Shoshana said, That was a Caucasian, the mercenary. Clint whipped his head to the rear, watching the SUVs disappear. He said, Mercenary, what are you talking about? Jennifer said, Shoshana, to the front, look across the field. Clint turned his head back around, seeing a line of men on their knees, seven others standing behind them holding AK-47s. Something straight out of Rwanda. Shoshana withdrew her Zev-Tech Glock, the RMR holosight and suppressor clearly showcasing the professional piece of weaponry it was, and Clint looked at her with new eyes. He said, "Who the fuck are you two?" She ignored the question, saying to Jennifer, "Straight in. Go straight in." Jennifer nodded, saying, "Clint, call your men. Tell them to get ready." He attempted to do so, but she left the road, cutting straight into the field, the uneven ground causing the vehicle to begin bucking up and down. Clint said, "Jesus Christ, hang on a second. Let me get a plan together." Jennifer floored it, ignoring the protest of the suspension and the shouting from Clint. They closed to within 50 meters before the men with the weapons reacted. The lead man raised his AK, firing the first shot of the battle. It hit the windshield between Jennifer and Shoshana, snapped by Clint's head, and exited out the back of the vehicle. Clint dove down in the seat, shouting into his radio. Shoshana opened the passenger door, stepped onto the running board of the SUV, and began shooting, knowing she wouldn't hit anything, but hoping to at least suppress the incoming fire. Jennifer said, "Clint, get them to flank. Go north." Clint made the call, and the second SUV broke away from their line of march, streaking north through the field. Jennifer continued straight ahead, and all the soldiers began firing at her vehicle, spider-webbing her windshield. Shoshana leapt off the running board, hitting the ground and rolling upright, squeezing the trigger as soon as she had a sight picture. The lead soldier of the line screamed, grabbing his shoulder. She broke the trigger again, and he dropped to the ground. The man behind him turned his aim from Jennifer's vehicle to her, chewing up the ground around her. She dove flat and began scrambling to a depression. Lying on the bench seat, Jennifer slammed on the brakes and screamed, "Get your guys in the fight!" She heard Clint in the back shouting into a radio, withdrew her Glock, and rolled out of the vehicle, circling to the rear, the steel of the vehicle pinging with incoming rounds. Clint joined her 5 seconds later, raising his M4 and putting down suppressive fire, ignoring the rounds impacting near him. Jennifer said, "What about the team?" Now calm in his element, Clint took aim, fired, and said, "Stand by." Jennifer poked her head around the bumper and saw the second SUV had stopped, the men boiling out, all firing. The soldiers in the field had no focus, no command element controlling them, and they paid for the mistake. In seconds, all 7 of them were dead. They watched the team sweep through the kill zone, checking bodies and securing the prisoners. Clint got a call on the radio, looked at Jennifer, and said, "All clear." 10 minutes later, they were fighting off the fawning of Thomas's inner circle, Thomas himself looking bemused at the turn of events. The team completed searching the dead bodies, and Thomas said, "This is becoming a habit with you two." Clint said, "What's he mean by that?" Shoshana said, "Nothing." Clint had had enough. His voice rising, he said, "What the fuck is this all about? You said they were going to murder a friend that worked at the hospital. A friend, as in a single man. You said it was happening at his house." Clint pointed at the abandoned hut and said, "That ain't no fucking house." He turned and pointed to the line of rescued men and said, "That ain't no single man." He finished by stabbing a finger at Shoshana's Glock. "And that ain't no set of nail clippers. I know you didn't bring it in your carry-on bag when you flew here for your bullshit missionary trip to Lesotho. Who the fuck are you?" Shoshana said, "This might be the time. I won't tell Pike." Clint glared and said, "What the hell does that mean?" Jennifer said, "I think it would be best if you just went back to the hospital and provided security. Sort of forgot all this happened."
84. I hung up my phone and, shouting over the wind, announced, "Jennifer and Shoshana were successful. Thomas is alive." Across from me, his feet splayed out, Aaron smiled and said, "Did you have any doubt?"
Yeah, I did. Like I do for this ridiculous plan. We were racing to the airport with the team in the bed of a pickup, Chris driving and Johan in the passenger seat. I'd looked for something better, but the pickings at the police headquarters had been pretty slim. The back parking lot was full of SUVs and sedans, both marked and unmarked, but I needed something to hide the team. Our new Lesotho police friend wanted to take the ones with official markings, but I was having none of that. We'd never get down the street without someone waving us over to stop a looting or prevent some other crime. The city was going a little nuts, the population not knowing for sure what was occurring, but everyone understanding it wasn't good, and it had been split between opportunists and dedicated citizens. The longer we remained at the police headquarters, the less likely we'd be able to drive out. I'd surveyed the lot and said, "This isn't going to work. We need a Trojan horse. Some way to get us all in undetected while showing Chris and Johan." I clicked on the net and said, "Veep, what the hell is taking you so long?" Johan had told us he had a commercial drone in his ruck, and I'd sent Veep to go fetch it. I heard, "I'm here! At the front! Where are you?" "Out back in the parking lot. Get that thing in motion." He appeared on the lot with a case about the size of a shoebox. I looked at Johan and said, "That drone can reach the airfield?" He said, "Oh yeah, it's pretty good." No sooner had I said it than Veep, our millennial genius, had the drone in the air, a little spider-looking thing floating about, waiting on instructions. Johan said, "You've only got about 25 minutes of air. Get it going." Veep did something with the controller, and the drone flew away, disappearing as quickly as a stone dropped off a cliff. I said, "Okay, the one thing we know is they're expecting Johan and Chris. Chris will drive, and Johan will be the prisoner." Johan said, "Well, I guess first things first." He turned to Aaron, held out a set of flex ties, and said, "Care to do the honors?" Aaron took them and cinched his wrists together, saying, "I was wrong about you." Johan watched him work and said, "No, you weren't. I'm not a good guy. I haven't been one in a long, long time." Aaron took his knife and slit the attachment for the tie, so that Johan could break it with a simple twist. He held up the blade, letting Johan see it. He said, "A knife can do both good and bad. It doesn't understand the difference. You do. You will probably die on this mission. In fact, I can't think of any way you won't. Yet you choose to do it. A conscious decision. Before that happens, I just wanted you to know I forgive you." Taken aback, Johan said,
"Thank you for that. I'm sorry for what I did to you."
Aaron said, "Just get this done, and know that no thanks are necessary." Aaron released his wrists, then said, "But if you fuck this up, Shoshana will skin you alive. And she has every reason to do so." Johan gave a half-hearted laugh, wanting to be in on the joke, but unsure of what it was. Aaron looked him in the eye and said, "That wasn't humor." Veep said,
"I'm over the airfield now, and it's not looking good."
We crowded around the screen, seeing immediately what he was talking about. The airfield was out by itself, with a two-lane road leading to the front of the building, the lone landing strip in the back. It was a single-story building without any jetways or other modern airport conveniences. Basically, it had a drive on the front side for letting people off, and a runway on the back side for boarding a plane. It looked like an airport in 1960s Mississippi. Veep said,
"One checkpoint on the way in, sporadic security at the tarmac."
I said, "Go back to the runway." He did, and we saw a C-130 on the tarmac, the ramp down and people loading. I said, "So Armstrong's on the ground, which means the clock is ticking." Knuckles nodded and said, "What's the plan?" Chris's radio squawked and he answered it, looking at us, knowing any wrong word would seal his fate.
"This is Chris, go. Bird's on the ground, Armstrong's here. Crew is loading up on a hot turnaround."
Meaning the aircraft wasn't even shutting down its engines. Chris said, "We're supposed to be on it. Is it going to wait?"
"No. You bring Johan. The bird's leaving without us. Don't worry,
Colonel Armstrong will get us out. Lenatha is happy with the reception. Feed these Kaffirs a sacrifice, and that's all it takes.
The words from the radio caused me to bristle. He was talking about Thomas. Chris said, "So you want me to come out now?"
"Yeah, get moving. Armstrong's talking to Lenatha about Johann. I think they want another sacrifice. Mosebo should be here soon. I've got his guys from the Prime Minister's house holding the airfield. Turns out killing that fuck was a good decision, because we needed the manpower. Johann didn't take into account the security required here. Either way, we're about to neat this thing up."
Chris looked at me, and I said, "Tell him you're on the way. But you don't trust the guard force protecting the airfield. Tell him you want to be sure you can get in without being killed." He did so, and Andy answered,
"Just get your ass here. The first vehicle we see is getting through. The next is getting toasted."
Chris said, "Give me 5 minutes and we're on the way." He dropped the mic and said, "I did what I could."
Johann said, "Let Chris take me alone. I'll kill Armstrong, Lenatha, and Andy. I promise I can get all three before they stop me."
Chris looked decidedly sick at the suggestion, because he knew he'd be in the middle of that firefight, forcing him to choose a side. I said, "That's not going to cut it. As much as I'd like to see those fucks bleed, it's still mission failure for my team." Veep said,
"Drone's coming back. I'm out of flight time."
I racked my brain, trying to come up with something that would get us in. Every infiltration course of action was foiled by that one lone road leading to the airfield. I had no aircraft for a halo op, no helicopters for a shock assault, no secret newspaper truck for a clandestine entry. I said, "We need a Trojan horse." Knuckles said,
"What about that pickup?"
He pointed to a beat-up Ford with more primer than paint.
"We can get in the back and cover ourselves with something. Trojan horse."
Brett said, "That's the dumbest idea I've ever heard." I said, "Yeah, and it just might work. Veep, find us something to cover the bed. Everyone else load up." 10 minutes later, we were closing on the airport, and I'd gotten the word from Jennifer about Thomas. Knuckles said,
"You're going to get them rolling here?"
"Yeah, I'll stage them with the police. Aaron, give Shoshana a heads up. Tell her to coordinate with Veep." Driven by Veep, the SUV behind us was full of Luzutu police, which I was going to leave on the shoulder of the road at the intersection of the airport entrance. Needless to say, Veep wasn't too keen on the babysitting task, but tough shit. It had to go to somebody I trusted. The intersection was about 400 meters away from the airport, making it close enough to call them in waving badges when we won. If we won. Johann pounded on the glass of the rear window and held up a single finger. I said, one minute, Knuckles passed a Veep. Here we go. We tucked down in the bed, and I dragged the tarp over us, Aaron and Knuckles working their end of the mission. Brett took the canvas and pulled it tight, saying, "I haven't done anything this stupid since high school." I tucked the tarp over my head, the light now blotted out, and looked at him in our little cave. "How'd that work out?" He grinned and said, "We went to jail, but I'm sure this'll be different."
85. Returning to the hospital in the trail of the Special Forces caravan, Jennifer had parked and then spent her time trying to placate Clint, but he was having none of it. The men of his team had seemed to appreciate what they'd done, and treated them with newfound respect, but Clint had been aggravated. He knew he'd been used, but still wasn't sure if he should be angry at the subterfuge or happy that he'd accomplished something worthwhile. Jennifer could see the dichotomy play out and recognized Pike in the battle. She knew which side would win. No man like Clint would remain pissed because he'd found a gunfight. Shoshana's phone rang, and she walked away to answer it. Jennifer said to him, "I appreciate the help. You did a good thing." He said, "Don't fuck with me. Next thing you'll tell me is that you have an issue with a submarine and a lake in the Highlands, and you need my help because you're a marine biologist." Jennifer repeated, "You did a good thing. Just take that for what it's worth." He grinned and said, "You're not going to tell me who you are you?" "We already did." "Bullshit. You don't work here. You're pretty good at pulling the strings. The Benghazi touch was the coup de grace. If I were to guess, I'd say this whole charade was just to save those men back there." He was close, but she couldn't tell him that his purpose was simply to show the flag. She said, "I appreciate the help. I really do. Please make sure these people are safe." He laughed and said, "So I never left here, right?" She said, "That's right, if you don't mind." He nodded, and Shoshana hung up her phone, saying, "We need to go." She turned from the SUV and shouted, "Thomas, get your ass over here. Time to get in the fight." Thomas came jogging toward them, and Clint said, "What's she talking about?" Jennifer leaned forward and kissed him on the cheek, saying, "Worry about the hospital. Leave it at that. Trust me." His men hooted at the gesture, and he said, "Okay, okay, you win. But one day I'm going to find out what happened here." Shoshana opened the door to their bullet-ridden SUV, letting Thomas take a seat. She said, "Wow, you gave up easy." She closed the door, and Clint said, "What does that mean?" Jennifer opened the driver's side and said, "Nothing. She just figured it would take a little more to get you on board." "Like what?" "You don't want to know." He said, "You got that right. She's scary as shit." Jennifer put the vehicle in gear before Shoshana could say anything crazy.
I felt the truck slow down for the checkpoint, and every man under the tarp tightened his grip on his weapon. If they wanted to check the bed, they'd have to lift the canvas. We all waited, praying for the darkness to remain. 1 inch of daylight, and we were coming out shooting, our surprise lost. I held my breath, hearing Chris talking through the window, wondering yet again whether it was good policy to put my fate into the hands of 2 mercenaries who had no loyalty to me or my team. I realized that worrying about someone ripping the tarp off of us wasn't the worst case. Johann could tell them to simply start shooting into the bed, and we wouldn't realize it until the first rounds ripped into our bodies. We began rolling forward again, and I let my breath out. Knuckles whispered, "Okay, they get some credit when we're done here." And I realized he'd been thinking the same damn thing. We drove for another 2 minutes, and I felt the vehicle turn, subtly shifting us in the bed. We were driving around the building toward the flight line. "Not long now." The truck stopped, and I heard Chris shout out the window. It was all Johann now.
Johann saw Andy on the airfield, but not Colonel Armstrong. The terminal was to their left, and he assumed the entourage was inside, which would make it hard for a quick reaction from the men in the bed. Andy walked up to Chris on the driver's side and said, "So, it looks like you and I get to stay in the new Prime Minister's residence tonight. Not bad." Chris said, "When are we leaving? I don't like this." "We'll be out of here tomorrow. Armstrong's got some business with Colonel Smith. Don't worry, he's not hanging around." He pointed at Johann and said, "He's got some business here as well. Get him out." Chris exited the door, went to the passenger side, and pulled out Johann. Andy said, "Hold him still." Chris did, and Andy ran his hands over Johann's torso, Chris saying, "I already searched him." Andy stood back up and said, "Can't be too sure." They marched to the entrance of the terminal, and Johann could see Armstrong and Lenatha inside. Surrounded by the same 4 of Lenatha's security men he'd seen when they met in Cape Town. One of them opened the door, and he was ushered inside. Armstrong had a smile on his face, but behind it was a smoldering anger. Johann had seen it once before, when Armstrong had destroyed the teenagers in the park. Johann was made to stand in front of Armstrong, Chris behind him, and Andy off to one side. Johann surveyed the threat matrix, seeing Armstrong and Lenatha were both unarmed, and while the four-man security detail showed bulges under their suit jackets, they had nothing in their hands. Yet. Andy was the only one with a visible weapon out, his Sig Sauer slung at his side. Armstrong said, "So, Lily boy, you thought you could teach the master a few tricks, is that it?" Johann said nothing. Armstrong slapped him across the face, screaming, "Answer me!" Johann rolled with the blow and then said, "You broke the contract. You know I don't work for terrorists." Armstrong laughed and said, "Is that what this is about? You found out about the payment to Tyler Malloy? I thought it had something to do with the moral high ground of Lesotho. All of this pain, and you didn't stop the transfer from happening. Must really hurt." Johann said, "What now?" Lenatha stepped forward, speaking for the first time. "Now, you traitor, you will get exactly what you deserve. When General Musibo arrives, I'll formally turn you over to him as an enemy of the people. I don't know how long he'll keep you alive, but I do know you'll probably wish it was shorter than it will be." Johann smiled and said, "Mosibo's dead, you little maggot." The news came as a shock to everyone but Chris. Armstrong started to speak when the sound of gunfire erupted outside the terminal.
86. Hidden under the tarp, I heard the conversation stop, then the sounds of footsteps retreating, then nothing but silence. I said, "Brett, take a peek." He did, cracking the tarp near the cab of the pickup and peering out. He said, "It went inside the terminal. I can't see anything through the glass. Can we exit?" "Front's got two security, but they're on the far side. If we were quick, we could get into the terminal alcove and they'd miss us. Knuckles, what about the rear?" Knuckles crawled to the tailgate and cracked the tarp, then slowly lifted his head. He immediately snapped back down like a turtle withdrawing into a shell. He hissed, "Two security headed right for us. Are they going to bypass, go inside the terminal? How the hell would I know? If I were to guess, since this shit show is your plan, I'd say no." He laid his rifle gently on the bed of the truck and withdrew his Glock. Brett and I did the same, repositioning our legs underneath us. We waited for what seemed like an hour, and then heard the footsteps. The men speaking in Sesotho. They stopped at the tailgate, and we held our breath. Then one of them grabbed the tarp, flinging it back. Knuckles rose like a jack-in-the-box from hell, drilling the first one in the head, then rotating to the second. The man got off one wild round, and Knuckles put him down. I threw off the tarp, saying, "Get to the terminal." Knuckles and Brett leapt over the side of the bed. I started to do the same and saw the two men from the far side of the airfield. They'd heard the single round and were running toward us to see what had happened. I laid my weapon on the roof of the truck and seated the buttstock. One of them took a knee and fired at the team scrambling for the terminal. I eased out my breath and broke the trigger. A split second later, he grabbed his chest and flopped on the tarmac, rolling in a death spasm. The man next to him oriented on me, and I saw him cut down by the team, both now in the alcove of the terminal. I leapt out of the bed and sprinted to them. I stacked behind Brett and heard gunfire from inside the terminal. I looked at Knuckles and said, "Go."
With the sound of the single AK-47 round still echoing in the air, and all eyes focused on the terminal windows, Johann raised his arms to his chest and yanked hard. The flex tie split down the middle, freeing his hands. He flicked his right arm down, and like magic, the handle of a double-edged fighting knife slid from his sleeve and into his palm. Andy caught the initial motion, and whirled to him, but not quickly enough. He raised